Welcome to Pharma Talk Radio. I'm Danny McCarthy. It's estimated that only 20% of health outcomes are due to clinical care, with the remaining 80% as a result of social determinants of health. In this podcast, Noelle Theodosiou, principal, founder, and CEO of Luminous, tells us how she's working with life science companies to understand and contextualize the real world that patients live in, to create therapeutics that fit in the environment to deliver actual impact.
Luminous is a global life science consultancy that connects lab and life to achieve better outcomes for patients, business, and society, with deep and revealing insights that can be leveraged across the development pathway to achieve products and services that are truly patient-centric.
Especially as the industry is moving into more complex medicines and navigating tight regulatory environments, understanding and reaching patients and creating therapies that actually meet their needs could save overall time, money, and effort. Noelle argues that taking an approach that combines biology, psychology, and sociology provides companies with decision-making capabilities that align on both good business practice and medicine developer social contract. Welcome, Noelle, to Pharma Talk Radio. Can you start by telling the audience about how you're helping life science companies generate medicine development insights that take into account patients' real-world environments?
Sure. So I've spent my career focused on really trying to understand different cultures and environments, different contexts. And I've spent my career focused on understanding people and how we serve them best. I initially worked actually as a consultant in market entry strategy. One of the things that I found when I first started working in the life sciences versus working in consumer goods that characterized the life sciences industry and the way they approach market research and patient research specifically, as well as provider actually, is that there's a temptation to and an inclination to go to providers or go to patients with our molecule, with our asset, with our device and say, here, we have this great, shiny, beautiful thing. What do you think? Do you like it? And I'm, of course, paraphrasing, but the mentality is, here's our innovation. What do you think about it? If I told you that our product, let's say it's a migraine product, it helped you achieve less migraine days per month. It helped decrease the severity of your migraine. Does that work for you? And that's a very different approach than the way we see innovation happening in consumer goods. The way we see innovation happening in consumer goods is they take a very much more exploratory approach to research. So what is your experience when you have a migraine? How does that feel? How doesn't that feel? That is an anthropological approach that has been used in the industry quite a bit. Our approach, I think, goes even further in that we don't just ask patients and providers and customers. We're looking at the culture and the environment informing their decisions, their ideas, their motivations, their experiences more implicitly. So we do all of that work before we even have a conversation with a patient or provider, seeking to understand what's informing their experience that they may not be able to tell us themselves. We often refer to this as an iceberg. You can see the tip of the iceberg. You can ask certain questions and people can respond, but they're responding from a culturally informed context, a socially informed context, an environmentally informed context, and a psychologically informed context. And all of that surrounds their experience and informs their experience.
What sparked your desire to focus specifically on this biopsychosocial approach to patient insights and medicine development?
I was lucky enough to join the workforce right after the Berlin Wall came down. And my job was to help multinational companies develop market entry strategies for the markets of Central and Eastern Europe. Those were markets that shared Western culture, but had a lot of different cultural dynamics individually. So one of my first projects was for Bristol-Myers Squibb, when they were saying, okay, this whole new market has opened up to us with the fall of the Berlin Wall. And we need to understand exactly how we're going to work in these markets. How are we going to distribute our product? What is the role of pharmacies? And what are the roles of pharmacists? And our discussion was really about, so how does it work when a patient gets a prescription and goes to the pharmacy? What is their relationship with the pharmacist? Do they trust the pharmacist? What role does the pharmacist play in filling that script? What advice do they give? How does that impact the relationships, the distribution, the uptake of product, the adherence, compliance, and persistence? I eventually started working more in healthcare and life sciences, And notice that in healthcare and life sciences, we always start with biology. We start with a molecule, or we start with a device or a technology that we want to turn into a therapy or a diagnostic. And obviously that is the core value in the research and development process. But sometimes we don't take into consideration the entire lived experience until later in the process, either until we're creating our go-to-market strategy or we're in market. And even then, we're quite focused from a product point of view. So I saw a little bit of a blind spot in the industry. How do we contextualize the biology, the science in the lived experience? And we're seeing a lot of moves in the industry and in the regulation and in the payer environment to achieve better outcomes in the real world. So this type of insight is extremely valuable. And we're finding a lot of interest and demand for finding new ways to generate these kinds of insights.
Why is it critical for industry especially to take this lens on medicine development?
We know that only 20% of a health outcome is attributable to the clinical experience. So 80% of the factors are things like social factors, cultural factors, environmental factors, and psychological factors. And if we don't understand that 80%, our chance of delivering a really good 20% are lessened. So we have, in a sense, an obligation to ensure that our product fits into the environment and delivers to the experience of patients and providers, or treaters, in a way that will be most effective. We are starting to see the impact of precision medicine on the patient experience and what that means in terms of really understanding individual patient contexts, drivers of their health experience, and drivers of their health. Where you live is a huge driver of your health. In the US, we spend more on healthcare than any other in developed economy, and our outcomes don't reflect that. We still have significant issues in terms of highest maternal and infant mortality. Life expectancy numbers are not what one would expect based on our spending, and significantly high numbers of multiple chronic conditions that impact people's health outcomes overall. We are obliged as an industry to think about how are we delivering to patients in this context. And by that, I mean that when therapies get to market, the uptake is strong and effective, that it's easy for people to prescribe, to gain the product, to access the product, particularly when these products are more personalized and require different methods of administration, such as infusions or injections. A big implication for the industry also in terms of life cycle management, in that a lot of companies do invest quite a bit in thinking about uptake, but the curve is quite steep on the uptake, and it's steep on the downtake as well, if I can use that expression. So it's one thing to bring great products to the market. It's another thing to sustain that delivery and that outcome. And that innovation process could potentially look very differently if we look at it through the patient lens at every stage and inform it with the patient lens at every stage, beyond just the biological, but including the psychological and the social.
What is the incentive for the industry to look at medicine development through biological and psychosocial lenses?
Naturally, companies look to make business decisions that sustain them and that grow their revenue and grow their profit. But I think it's important to take a wider lens on this. As an industry, we provide very essential goods. And so what that means in terms of our social contract and the expectations that society has of us, it's like we're working to a higher bar. We have a duty of care, is how I would frame it up. That is very different, again, than other industries, and we have to serve that. So I think that's something to take into consideration when we're thinking about the business decisions that we're making, which does not mean that we should make decisions at the expense of our business. It means that we should make decisions that effectively address the intersection of the business need and patient needs and health needs, because that's our role in society.
How does this differ or build upon the ways that companies are already seeking to identify the context in which patients receive care and receive these therapeutics?
Companies invest already a lot in fairly robust and important anthropological methods that inform market research methods, also that inform patient journeys and provide insights. I think we could go more deeply when it comes to clinical trial design, particularly related to minority or minoritized communities. So I mentioned earlier that there are a lot of factors that go into innovation and developing healthcare solutions that work as well in the real world as they do in a clinical trial that we can't get by directly asking people. So one of the tools in our toolbox is semiotics. That is a field that was brought into market research in consumer goods a long time ago about understanding meaning making and how people understand products or how they understand their environments, how they relate to things in ways that are unspoken. We have innovated with some of the leaders in the field to build biology in with semiotics now into a field, into a discipline called biosemiotics, which is very established in academia, but not in the applied world. Biosemiotics is about understanding what's informing all of our human health, all of the human health experience beyond biological function, including psychology and sociology and context, and all those implicit factors. So that rather than sort of showing up with our asset and our molecule and our device and seeing how it works, we are informing it from the get-go with the context in which it will be placed and how it will be used. I call this sharpening the pencil because long ago when semiotics was first used by Procter & Gamble to inform product development and innovation and even communications, they did a study of all the work they had done that was informed by semiotics, like product concepts and communications concepts, versus the work that they had done that was not informed by semiotics. The work that was informed by semiotics performed 80 to 90% better in customer testing than those products that weren't. Because basically what you're doing with this method is you're seeking to understand people's context, the part of the context that they can't explain to you if asked. It's very implicit and unconscious in their experience. You're seeking to understand that through expert analysis in advance. And then you're developing products, ideas, concepts, communications, education materials, support programs, everything that you need to do to bring your product to market informed by those insights. It saves money and it also results in a better product and better outcomes for patients.
Can you share an example of how using biosemiotics and the psychosocial lens changed a company's approach to a patient group or to developing a therapeutic?
One example of something we worked on in rare disease is growth hormone deficiency. One of the interesting things about growth hormone deficiency, when you think about it from a biopsychosocial perspective, is that a child's lack of growth means that they're physically smaller than their chronological age. Their relationships are affected both within their families and beyond their families. Their social circles and their social engagement and their development actually is affected. And then when those patients are treated and their chronological age and their physical age start to match, their relationships again change. One of the interviews we did after we did some cultural analysis was with an endocrinologist who pointed out that one of the critical things that she likes to point out to parents is if your child is not growing and you are treating them as a child based on their size as opposed to based on their age, then you are not helping them developmentally. So when you are a company that's coming to the market or wanting to launch, let's say, a once weekly growth hormone therapy, how are you taking that into consideration? Some patients are on growth hormone for some number of years. Some patients are on growth hormone for many years. And as they also grow and become adolescents and become independent, their product use is also different. They take responsibility versus their parents taking responsibility for making sure that they comply and adhere. So there's another shift there in terms of many diseases, not just growth hormone deficiency, but many diseases of patients with rare disease where developmentally they evolve. Shouldn't their treatments evolve with them? Those are all considerations. So product development considerations, go-to-market considerations, which stakeholders are you engaging? How are you supporting patients and their parents or caregivers in treatment transitions, in developmental questions as related to treatment and relationships, and ultimately in terms of, you know, their quality of life socially and environmentally? So I talked earlier about flattening the curve. The impact of a product or a device is not just the impact within the first 90 days, it's the sustained impact.
Thank you for that example showing us how this approach looks in the rare disease space. Can you illustrate for anyone listening how this might look in a broader patient population?
So one of the things that became clear when the GLP-1s were first launched for obesity was that there were some implicit biases in the healthcare system as it relates to treating obesity. There were cultural biases against people with obesity in society. They were regarded as, you know, lazy and irresponsible. And the sense within the healthcare community, even within the healthcare community, was that weight was a matter of personal responsibility. So what was existing in our culture translated to into the healthcare system. There were people with obesity who weren't being treated for other conditions because healthcare providers would say, hey, you know, you should lose weight and then we'll talk about your sore knee. That implicit bias was evident in the system. And by looking and understanding that implicit bias, we were able to understand what did we need to do in terms of disease education? What did we need to do to explain the physiology of the body in ways that maybe hadn't been explained before, which was going to, in a sense, challenge our cultural notions around obesity and explain that there's something going on in the body with our metabolisms where your body set point changes. And by explaining that simply, explaining the biology and the physiology simply, we can start to change the conversation about obesity. So that was about figuring out how do we support communities that need our help, both within the provider community and patients, to have better conversations. That includes educational materials as well as different types of support.
What would you say to people who still may not be convinced of this approach as a business strategy?
The way I see it is that it's about expediting your path to market. It's about ensuring that when you go to market, you get uptake with the patients and the provider through the providers that are best suited for the product. You're able to meet patients where they are and create an effective experience for them that leads to better outcomes and costs the whole healthcare system less. It's one thing to say, look, within the 20%, I have an impact on, I can design my product well, I can engage patients and providers to the extent that I'm able to the extent that I have the budget to make those investments. I think what we're saying is you may not have all the resources in the world to change the 80%, but if you're not aware of the 80%, your 20% doesn't have a chance. So the better outcomes you achieve with a product that has the right support around it, the less payers expend, it's better for employers. And I don't think we even should think about, you know, whether this is better for patients or not. It's clearly better for patients. Most other industries have really been forced to put their ultimate end user customer at the center. And it's been our expectations of products are pretty high overall. For some reason in healthcare, we have a lot of hopes, but there's a lot more opacity around that process and around how those outcomes are achieved. So we have a lot of learning to do to get there.
What would you encourage as the first steps for any listeners?
So there are a couple of calls to action in my mind. One of them is, I think it always pays to take a step back. And I think the industry does need to constantly remind itself that, yes, we are an industry and need to make a profit. We also have a duty of care. And society expects more from us than even just medicines. They expect good moral decision making in balance with our business decision making. So when the conversation shifts to the cost benefit, this is not just about saving the most money or doing things the most cheaply or doing things that are going to make us more money. This is about doing the right things for patients and making good business decisions at the same time. Another key call to action for the industry is to widen its lens. So we are experts in the biology and the science and the therapeutic areas. There's a lot of knowledge. As we were saying earlier, there are a lot of practices to understand the patient journey and the patient experience, but we have to understand the entire experience and we have to serve the whole experience thinking through a biopsychosocial lens. I think the last call to action is also something that we've made a commitment to with regard to health equity. Health equity is not just a moral responsibility of addressing it, but the guidances from the FDA are really about how do you make medicines and therapies that impact the largest populations possible and don't just work in a very small population. And a lot of the things that drive health inequity are things that are in that 80% we talked about, right? Where people live, what access they have to care, their environments, their cultural attitudes and biases, and their general health behaviors and health literacy. So those are all things that we have to work on for our therapies to be able to land effectively and be effective for the people who need them. Obviously, health equity is too big just for the life sciences industry by itself to deal with. This is a big societal problem. But I would challenge the industry to think about what is its role. We've made a commitment that all the work we do will, in every engagement we do, we will look at the health equity issues related to the condition that we're working on and make some recommendations to our clients about that. And I think this is about trying to find the different practices that you can integrate at every stage of development and commercialization that support greater equity and decrease disparities.
If you look to the future, what does medicine development look like if we really embrace the biopsychosocial approach?
We need to move away from validating, which is the mindset of a scientist, validating our solutions to co-creating and exploring together and discovering together. So the idea of co-creating with a patient and the idea of co-creation in general to drive innovation is something that other industries accept as almost a norm and can be brought into the life sciences industry. So this means envisioning together a world where we have Alzheimer's, but we have a great quality of life. What does that look and feel like? What does that look and feel like socially, psychologically, environmentally, and biologically, and bring all those things together? That would be an incredible opportunity, and it would significantly transform every step of development. You might actually completely redesign a clinical trial or change your path to market as a result of that type of collaboration. And that's something that we're hungry to do and be involved with. And there are early signs that the industry is doing that by partnering with patients earlier in the design of clinical trials, but we think it can go a lot further. And it would be a great future to see.
Thank you so much, Noelle, for sharing these insights. Again, Noelle Theodosio is principal, CEO, and founder of Luminous. For more information on PharmaTalk Radio podcasts, you can visit theconferenceforum.org. Thank you for listening.